Thanks again to everyone who's read, helped us open the meeting, and I take this opportunity to welcome those that may have joined us since we first started. Welcome to any visitors to our meeting this evening, and a massive welcome to any newcomers, and we hope that you hear something tonight that's going to help you decide to keep coming back. So like I said, we are a speaker meeting this evening, and it does fall upon me to introduce our speaker, and I'm really delighted to introduce our speaker this evening. This is an individual I've known for quite a number of years, I think, in one place or another in the internet. And I came close to actually going over to where she lives and staying and visiting her at one point, but unfortunately things happened that got in the way, and that is what it is. But maybe one day, maybe it's on my bucket list to go to where she lives. So I have a huge amount of respect for this individual's recovery, and I'm hoping that she's going to share her experience, strength and hope with us for the next 40 or 45 minutes, whatever she's comfortable with. And Lynn, I'll just hand it over to you. Lynn, please share with us. The floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me okay? Very low. Okay. How about now? Is that better? All right. So it's a mixed bag. I'll try to speak as loud as I can, and there's a recording, so you may be able to catch it after. So I'm Lynn. I'm an addict. And thank you, Steve. I don't know if I'm going to make it to 40 minutes. We shall see. We shall see where this goes. I'm going to try and, you know, I'm so used to wham, bam, speaking jobs. So I'll start simply by saying that, my clean date is January 28th, 1983. I got clean in New York. I would say that my entire recovery was in New York, has been in New York. I got clean when I was 20 years old. I think it was exactly 8 weeks after my 20th birthday, I wound up in rehab. And, you know, the thing about this disease is that everything that's good for me, everything that's positive and healthy is not what this disease wants for me and not the direction that it leads me in. And I say this because it is a struggle. I can't say it's a constant struggle. I can't say every day is horrible. It's not. But anyone who thinks that it gets easier with more clean time is mistaken. The disease doesn't go anywhere. It gets smarter, it gets stronger, it gets more subtle and more cunning. And so I always have to be vigilant about my recovery. I don't get to slack off because I have X number of years clean. And I will say that what I've learned in recovery is that what we say, that whole thing about clean time doesn't equal recovery. I'm sure everyone knows someone, and they can't believe that that person has X number of years clean because the way that they behave doesn't seem like recovery behavior. So I guess what we've learned is that you can be clean without having any recovery, but you can't have recovery without being clean. And so the thing is, my program or how I work the program to the best of my ability isn't because I want to win a prize. I don't want to be on a pedestal. I don't want people running after me or anything like that. It's that I know how sick I am. I know how strong this disease is. I consider my disease to be a death wish. And I don't want to die. I was given not just a second chance at life with recovery, but I've been given several chances at life, and I continuously choose to say yes, I want to live, and I will die with this disease. I don't have to die from this disease. And today my recovery includes, you know, not just what we say freedom from active addiction, and for me, freedom from active addiction includes many substances, not just what we talk about in the literature, not just drugs prescribed or illicit, but also anything that is harmful to me that I do in excess. And to be honest with you, if I like it and it's harmful, I will do it in excess. I've learned that much about myself in recovery. So it doesn't matter if it's cigarettes or food, especially sugar. It doesn't matter if it's overspending. It doesn't matter if it's rage. Anything that's harmful is, for me, substance abuse. And I am absolutely susceptible to it. So I had 38 years clean this past January. And that has not changed. And I've learned that, you know, so, okay, I'll back it up a little bit. I still have a healthy fear and respect of relapse. I have no reason to believe that I'll make it back should I pick up. And I think about that as real for a couple of reasons. One, I'm 58 years old, and I have no reason to believe that my system could handle whatever drugs I pick up, and I don't even know what I would pick up. Two, I have no reason to believe that I could put it back down and come back. And whether that's a pride thing or whether that's because I know that when I'm stuck in addictive behavior, I mean, it took me, I don't even know how many years in recovery to stop smoking. I would put it down and pick it up and put it down and pick it up. It took, I know I stopped smoking a couple of months after my mom died, and that was February 2007. I consider my smoking date May 1st, 2007. So, what does that mean? I'll be 14 years without smoking in May if I don't pick up a cigarette. So that means that it took me like 20 plus years in recovery to let that addiction go. So I think that what I've learned from my struggles with other substances, other ways of distracting myself, other ways of destroying myself, other ways of resisting what this program is asking me to do, I think I have enough references without picking up to believe that it would be no different with any other substance. And I don't want to lose everything that I've gotten in recovery. And I don't mean money or anything like that, but I do mean the relationships that I have that I'm so grateful for. I would be nothing without those connections and those people, that support system. And also the relationship I have with a higher power. I don't want to lose that. It's just so precious to me. So when I got clean, NA in New York was very young, maybe 2 or 3 years old, if that. And when I got clean, there was, I think there were 7 meetings in all of New York City. Now, I don't know where everybody's from, but the geography of New York City is that it's 5 boroughs, Manhattan, Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, and Staten Island. And so just the island of Manhattan, there were 2 meetings in Manhattan when I got clean. And so what that meant was that for me to do 90 meetings in 90 days, I had to do a lot of traveling. So buses, subways, if I caught a ride, but it was no different than when I was using. And these are the things that I was told when I was in treatment. That, you know, it was completely based on 12 steps. I know that the other fellowship brought meetings in. I just don't remember them. I remember the NA meetings. And, you know, when I went into rehab, it was that I would do anything to stop using. I figured out on my 20th birthday what it was to be an addict. Because I had been telling myself, you know, I'm not shooting anything, I'm physically addicted to anything, which was a lie because I had become physically addicted to something. I conveniently forgot that. But what I realized on my 20th birthday was that I had spent the entire year trying to control my using. And there was not one day from my 19th birthday to my 21st birthday that I didn't have some substance in my system. And so what I realized on my 20th birthday was that being an addict doesn't mean necessarily that you're physically addicted to a chemical. Anybody can become physically addicted to a chemical. It doesn't mean that you're an addict. An addict is someone who uses against their will. An addict is someone who can't stop. And that's when I realized that's what I am. But because I had just spent a year trying to control my using, I had given up because I thought, well, I can't stop. So I guess I'm going to die from this. And I really didn't think I was going to see my 21st birthday. But then, you know, maybe 6 or 7 weeks after I had that epiphany, my sister, I didn't know it at the time, but she had 12-stepped me. So I always feel like my spiritual awakening happened in three pieces. One was when I realized that I was, in fact, an addict. The second was when I took my sister's offer when she came to pick me up. And, you know, she lied to me, actually. She said, I would like to come and hang out with me for a few days at my place. But she took me to a meeting. But on the way there is when she asked me that question that I think we're all asked by someone. What would you do if I told you you didn't have to feel this way anymore? And then a week later, I was in a hospital. And there, I had gone to my first NA meeting clean. Because when I went with my sister, I was already high. And when I went to that, well, they didn't call it H&I then. You know, it was just a meeting that they brought into to a facility for the residents or the, you know, patients of the facility. They did all the readings, and that was the first time I heard all the readings. And that was the third prong of the tripod, because I completely identified with all of those readings to the point where I was very uncomfortable sitting in that room, because I thought, how did they, it's like they wrote it for me. Like, I am a textbook addict. You know, there's nothing special about me in that regard. I'm totally textbook. I am in every single one of those readings. And that was it for me, you know. And they had the steps and traditions up on the wall. You know, I did what we all do. Like, I'm picking and choosing. But the thing is, I read them. I read those steps. And I just knew. It's just so bizarre that, like, a 20-year-old snot-nosed, not even really a newcomer yet, like, maybe I was clean a couple of days, I didn't know what the road was going to be in front of me. I knew that that was the thing that was going to save my life. And honestly, that has never changed. Whatever has happened to me inside the universe of Narcotics Anonymous, whatever has happened to me with other addicts, in service, with sponsors or sponsees, whatever has happened, however painful or sad or ugly or whatever, I have never, ever thought, this isn't for me, fuck NA, I'm not an addict. I've never thought any of those things. I don't know why. I'm not saying that I'm such a good girl, but that is a truth for me that has never, ever wavered. And thank God for that, for me. So what that means for me is, looking at these people who are bringing this meeting in, and they're so happy to be there, and they're so happy to see us, and I'm just thinking, they have something that I don't have, and they know something that I don't know. But you know what? I'm going to do whatever they tell me to do. And I know that, you know, we try to be very kind, and I think we should always be kind. And, you know, it's just a suggestion. We say it's just a suggestion. But I think I heard a definition of suggestion, which is a gentle command, you know. And the analogy that I always heard was somebody's learning how to jump out of airplanes and, you know, do I need the parachute? You know, well, I would suggest that you use the parachute if you're going to jump out of the plane. And none of that really meant anything to me at the time because, you know what? I didn't want to die. I just didn't know how to live. And so if these people have a way, and that's what we say, right? This is a way of life. So if they have a way of life that might provide me with a way to live my life, and I don't know how to do that, I'm going to do whatever they tell me to do. I mean, really, fuck it. At that point, I already, at 20, I had lost everything that a 20-year-old could possibly, you know, collect. My apartment, my job, I couldn't work. I couldn't hold on to money if all I did was buy drugs. And plus, this is 1983 in New York. I'm 20 years old. I was kind of cute at the time. It's really amazing that a lot of other bad things didn't happen to me by the time I got clean. Because we've all heard horror stories of what people have to do to get their drugs. I was determined to take every suggestion they gave, and they talked a lot about willingness. And I am of the mind today that of those three that are indispensable, honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, I'm of the mind that willingness is the most important. Without willingness, I personally can't be honest or open-minded. I have to be willing to walk through the fear of maybe being humbled or humiliated or feeling ashamed of the thoughts that I have or the things that I've done or what you're going to think about me, because the only thing that matters is that I believe that there are certain things that I must submit myself to in order to keep my recovery. And what I need to submit myself to are those spiritual principles that we find in the steps and in the program itself. So what did they tell me to do? You get out of here and you go to a meeting. And I did. I left that rehab, I don't know, whatever time of day it was, I know it was a Friday, and I already knew the meeting I was going to that night. And it was in the Bronx, and I was in Manhattan, and it was the winter. And I got up there. I got to that meeting, and I was met by a room full of people all much older than me. And so I'm like, oh, you know, like, what do I have in common with these people? They told me you make a meeting every day for 90 days. You get phone numbers. You come early and you stay late. And I did everything they told me to do. You know, I got there early. I helped to set up the rooms. I stayed late. You know, I mean, we smoked in meetings. And we didn't just smoke. We used, like, old coffee tins for the ashtrays. And they all had, like, a little water in the bottom of it. It's so disgusting. I cleaned out the ashtrays. So I did. I got phone numbers. There were not as many women as there were men. I got a sponsor. I actually think she took me hostage, but it doesn't matter. I got a sponsor. She was my sponsor for the first 4 months of my recovery until I actually chose a sponsor myself, who stayed my sponsor for 30 years. And I'm still friends with her today. And you know, what do they used to say? I don't know if anyone ever said to me, work the steps or die, motherfucker. Also, nobody ever told me to sit down and shut the fuck up. Nobody ever said any of those things to me. And everyone insists somebody said to them. I never heard it. Nobody said it to me, and I never heard them saying it to anybody else. So those are meetings, I guess, I didn't go to. But because it was a small fellowship, we saw each other all the time because there was a limited number of meetings. Basic text was not available yet. I didn't even know it existed. It really meant nothing to me. You know, I had a little white book, and there were a couple of pamphlets that I kept on me. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have internet. So I called my sponsor once a day from work. I knew when she had lunch. And then I saw her that evening at a meeting, And that's what my life was like for quite some time. And to be honest, I went to a meeting every day for the first 4.5 years of my recovery. And the only reason I stopped that schedule was because I got sick. I was diagnosed with cancer. And so for the next 3 years of my recovery, I was not able to go to a meeting every day because, you know, chemo, surgeries, I had other stuff going on. But when I could, I was at a meeting. Because really nothing was more important to me than that. And also I did service. So I did everything that I was told to do. And I can tell you that once I, you know, so I was about 24, 24 and a half when I got sick. I was done with the cancer when I was about 28. And then I threw myself into school. I had not gone to university after high school because I didn't think that I would be able to cope. And I went after I was given a clean bill of health. And so I went right from cancer to going to college full time and working full time, like trying to make up for lost time. But really what we're talking about here is that I was doing everything that I was supposed to be doing. But I wasn't talking about how I felt or the things that I thought, and mostly about myself, because what I thought was there must be something wrong with me that I'm 10 years clean and I hate myself. And what I didn't know at the time is because we were such a young fellowship, there were very few people who had any real appreciable amount of clean time more than me. And not that that would have necessarily mattered, but it wasn't like there were, you know, people with 20, 30 years wandering around just basically saying, you know, don't worry about it. You're right where you're supposed to be. So I really thought that I should be better than I was at that point in my recovery. And I couldn't tell anybody that because I thought I would be rejected. And I couldn't tell anybody the other thought. Well, I don't know if I couldn't or I wouldn't. At the time, it felt like I couldn't. But obviously, I was living in fear, and I chose to believe that that fear was telling me the truth. I didn't want to tell anybody the other thoughts I had about myself or the way that I felt about myself because, again, I was ashamed. And it was very painful. I guess it was like, I like to say I had a little bit of a nervous breakdown, but I think really it was more like a spiritual crisis because I really thought at 10 years clean, I had done the steps with my sponsor. So what's wrong? You know, what's wrong? Why do I still feel this way? And I'm saying this, well, partially because it is my story, but also because I really want to share with people that so if I'm judging myself for what I think is the quality of my recovery, that's not coming from a loving place. That's not coming from a loving higher power. That's not a spiritually centered perspective on myself or others. And I didn't really understand that at the time. That I'm feeding on this negativity and feeling on these hateful thoughts because really the issue, and it took me a while to figure this out, really the issue was that I didn't have a solid relationship with the higher power, you know. And the person that I was when I was 30 was not the person that I was when I was 20 or 23 or 24. And if my relationship with my higher power had not grown at that point, had not evolved at that point, was not more open, then that should have been a red flag for me. And it finally did become a red flag that, I finally hit this wall. What I realized was there aren't enough things that I can do. There aren't enough good grades that I can get. There isn't enough service that I can do. There aren't enough good deeds that I could do to make me feel better about myself. And that what I'm lacking, which is self-acceptance and trust and faith in the process, this is in direct proportion, in direct relation to how well had I really turned my will and my life over to the care of God. It all went back to those first three steps, which is what should have happened, because 1, 2, and 3 are all about developing a relationship with a higher power. And what I realized was I had to do that again. Because I was one of those people who thought like, oh, do I have to go back to that step? I should have never left those steps. I mean, they're not 1, 2, and 3 because they're beginner steps. They're 1, 2, and 3 because they're absolutely the most critical. That none of the other work can be done. None of the other recovery, none of the other transformation can happen for me if I don't have 1, 2, and 3 very strong in my life. That's for me. I can't speak for anybody else, but that's what it is or was for me. It still is that way today. And so I spent like the next 5 years of my recovery working only on 1, 2, and 3, working only on every single thought I had, every single fear I had, every single hateful idea that I had about myself. And really all I did, I mean, I went to meetings. I wasn't doing any service. I was hardly talking to anyone, but I went to meetings. Every single day I went to meetings. I had, and the rest of the time I spent doing whatever I thought at the time was a way of trying to figure out what is my understanding of a higher power, and not what that it should be what I want it to be, but what does it want from me? And what I like to say, I have a sponsee here right now, and two sponsees actually, but one of them I think I've said this to, that I wanted. What I always wanted when I was younger in recovery was I wanted to be, a Buddhist or an atheist. Like those two would have been okay. I wanted to be a skinny Buddhist. And what I ended up being was a fat Catholic. Because, I think I'm going to control this relationship. And I'm not. I have no control whatsoever. The only thing that it tells us in the basic text in terms of your higher power is that it should be loving and caring, right? It doesn't tell us anything else. And at a certain point, if I really, how do I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him? If my understanding is something that's punitive and authoritarian and, scary, why would I turn my will and my life over to the care of that? I don't want anything to do with that. Like I, not realizing it, but I made my father my higher power. That was not going to work for me. And so it took me about 5 years to come to a place of understanding what I couldn't understand, and really what I came to was that I need a power greater than myself that is greater than every other power greater than myself. If everyone who's listening to me right now, you are all a power greater than me because I can't make you do anything. But none of you are a power greater than me that can restore me to sanity. My disease is a power greater than me. I am no match for my disease. But it's not a power greater than me that's going to restore me to sanity. And so I needed a power greater than every other power greater than me. And if it was a power greater than human, if it was a power greater than my disease, then the only thing I could get in my little brain was that that higher power's understanding of loving and caring is probably so beyond my comprehension that what we call unconditional love and unconditional acceptance, I don't think I, as a human being, will ever, ever understand or attain the unconditional love of a power greater than me. And that was a higher power that I could turn my will and my life over to. And everything changed for me at that point. And that for me, this entire program, you know, we like to say that it's a spiritual, not religious program, which is true, but it is a spiritual program and it is based on the application of spiritual principles. It's not based on the application of a stereo. Well, look at how I'm dating myself. It's not based on the kind of manual that you get when you're putting together piece of furniture. It's pretty simple, but it's spiritual principles. And that's what this program is based on. And that's what this way of life is based on. And if I can't apply those principles, how do I recover? If I won't apply those principles, how do I recover? So now I'm in that category of, I have clean time, but not recovery. I don't want that. I need recovery. I want to become the person, or I want to recover the person that I was always supposed to be, but didn't think I could, because I didn't think I would be safe. You know, I come from a place of, and I'm, everybody has a different story. A lot of people have a disease of addiction, and they don't come from a place of abuse. So the two are not necessarily 100% correlated, and we shouldn't necessarily make that correlation. But I did come from a place of a lot of abuse. And my entire childhood was about figuring out how to protect myself from harm to the best of my ability. And what kind of a plan do you think a child is going to cobble together? You know, it's not like a child is as a sophisticated thinking of an adult. Some adults anyway. But I lived my entire life based on that survival plan. And, you know, we call them really character defects. They were my survival skills. Because I really thought that I had to be the one to protect myself. And it took me a very long time in recovery to understand that there is actually no such thing as protection. I mean, obviously, we all take precautions. Because there are certain things that are within our control. But in terms of whether or not a person is going to hurt me, whether or not they're going to lie to me, whether or not they're going to let me down, whether I'm going to let myself down, whether I'm going to disappoint other people, we're human and we're flawed and all those things are going to happen. And it doesn't mean that I'm stupid or letting someone hurt me. Most of the time, people aren't going out of their way to hurt me. They're just being themselves. And maybe who they are is not someone that I can relate to. Maybe they're just human and they made a mistake and it hurts. Maybe my feelings got hurt or whatever. But very few people are actually out to get me. But I lived my life thinking that people were out to get me and I had to protect myself. And so everything in this program is asking me to let go of all that stuff. How the fuck do I do that and protect myself at the same time? You know, so this was a real dilemma for me, and it was a dilemma that was sort of below my radar. You know, it was only the last 10 years or so that I realized every place that I would go, every decision I would make, I always had to have a plan B. Like I'm always operating from a place of, you know, free floating fear. How am I going to get out of this room? Where are the escape exits? You know, if I'm going in your car, do I have a way home? You know, all those things. And the reality is, the only protection is in the knowledge that if I trust this process, and if I do believe in a loving, caring, higher power, that no matter what the outcome is, that somehow I am going to be all right. That not only do I not have to use over anything that happens, but that I'm going to survive it. You know, if I survived child abuse and I survived a pretty bad car accident and I survived cancer, and it was a cancer that I should have died from that cancer. I was actually the first person to be cured from that cancer. But if I survived all these things, you know, then why can't I survive unemployment or being fired or someone breaking up with me or someone passing away? Like, why do I think I can't survive it? And part of it is because we don't like feeling a lot of feelings. That's why we use drugs. I mean, we're all amateur chemists at heart. You know, let me concoct some chemical compound that's going to manipulate my feelings. You know, I have a theory about, I don't even know how much time I've taken up. I think I've run the gamut here. I have a theory that we say, the basic text tells us, or the 12-step programs tell us that this disease is threefold and that recovery is threefold, right? It's physical, mental, and it's spiritual. It never mentions emotional, you know. And I believe my theory is that this is because there's actually nothing wrong with anything that we feel. We just don't like most of them. And we have to figure out a way to distract ourselves from the discomfort of uncertainty, the discomfort of so many of our feelings. And that's what recovery is. It's being able to coexist with discomfort, with fear, with sadness, without having to make it worse, without having to set the house on fire, without having to do harm to ourselves or others, but to just live with it until it passes. So I think that I've taken up more time than I thought I would. So I want to stop here, and I hope that I said something sensible. The last thing I am going to say before I shut up is that it doesn't matter where we are in our recovery. It doesn't matter how much or how little time you think you have or you want to have, or none of that matters really. All of that is the result of doing the work. And all we need to do the work is to be in the day and to do what's in front of us and to take advantage of all the tools that we have been given so that we can do the work and become the people that we're supposed to be. So anyway, I'm going to end there and thank you very much.